Welcome to HN Pod, your daily deep dive into the top stories, trends, and discussions from the front page of Hacker News. I am Sarah.
And I am Mike. It is great to be here with you all. Today we are covering the top stories from yesterday, March 26th, 2026. This is episode number 347, and we have a really fascinating lineup for you today.
We really do. We're looking at a sobering piece on the dystopian reality of prediction markets, a massive, down-to-the-wire privacy victory in the European Union, a practical guide to ditching GitHub for Codeberg, and finally, we'll wrap up with some terminal shell tricks that might just save your sanity.
Let us jump right into that first story. This one got over 600 points and sparked a massive debate. It is a piece by Derek Thompson over on his Substack titled, "We Haven't Seen the Worst of What Gambling and Prediction Markets Will Do to America."
This article is an intense read. Thompson is basically arguing that we've completely normalized gambling to a dangerous degree, and the rise of prediction markets like Polymarket and Kalshi is taking us into some really dark territory. He gives three real-world examples that sound like they are straight out of a cyberpunk novel.
Right. The first one was about baseball. Back in November 2025, two pitchers for the Cleveland Guardians were indicted for rigging pitches. Not throwing whole games, just throwing specific pitches into the dirt because bettors paid them to do it. It's so micro-level that no fan watching would ever notice, but the fraudsters made nearly $500,000 off it.
And it gets much heavier. Thompson talks about a user on Polymarket who made a highly specific, low-odds bet that the U.S. would bomb Iran on a specific day in February. A few hours later, the bombs dropped, and this user walked away with over $500,000. He points out that it's almost impossible to believe this person did not have inside government information. We are literally looking at the financialization of war and geopolitical tragedy.
He also mentions a journalist who reported on missile strikes near Jerusalem, and bettors who had money on the exact locations of those strikes started harassing the journalist, threatening to make his life miserable if he did not rewrite his story to match their bets. $14 million were on the line.
The scale of this industry is just staggering now. Thompson points out that 9 years ago, Americans bet less than $5 billion on sports. Last year, that number was $160 billion. He put it in a great context. $5 billion is what Americans spend at coin-operated laundromats. $160 billion is what we spend on domestic airline tickets. It swallowed the culture whole.
The Hacker News comments on this were really insightful, though a few people did fact-check some of Thompson's numbers. A user named Furloop pointed out that Thompson conflated trading volume with revenue. He claimed Kalshi and Polymarket had a combined $50 billion in revenue, but that is actually their trading volume. Kalshi's actual fee revenue was around $260 million. Still a massive number, but a very important distinction in the finance world.
Absolutely. But the human element in the comments was what really caught my eye. A user who moved to the US from the UK noted that online gambling has been legal in the UK and Ireland for years, and it has been such an obvious negative for society there. They mentioned they actually refuse to hire people who work on optimizing these addictive gambling products. Another commenter shared a really sad story about a friend whose husband secretly lost their life savings and their kids' college funds to sports betting and day trading.
There was also a fascinating anecdote from a user named Will Terman. He grew up in Nevada and took a college course on the economics of gaming back in 2008, taught by the founder of Gambling Studies. For their final exam, a huge chunk of their grade was based on predicting the electoral map and placing a wager on whether the stock market would rise or fall the day after the election.
Wow. Tying a college grade to a literal stock market wager?
Exactly. The student realized the only way to guarantee they would not fail was for the entire class to collude, which the professor admitted was a valid game theory approach. But it just shows how deeply ingrained this mindset is. As that commenter pointed out, the negative externalities of gambling that Nevada has dealt with for a century are now being exported to every smartphone in the country. It is a Pandora's box, and it does not look like we can close it.
It really is. Speaking of Pandora's boxes, let us move to our next topic, which is actually a rare piece of good news for digital privacy. We had two related posts dominating the front page yesterday about the European Parliament voting to stop Chat Control 1.0.
This is huge. For context, Chat Control is the controversial EU legislation that allows US tech companies like Meta, Google, and Microsoft to indiscriminately scan private messages, looking for illegal material, specifically child sexual abuse material. The temporary regulation allowing this was set to expire, and conservative forces in the EU Parliament were pushing hard to extend it.
But in an absolute thriller of a vote, the Parliament rejected it. And when I say thriller, I mean it passed by a single vote. One single vote stopped the automated assessment of private photos and chats. So as of April 4th, 2026, the EU derogation expires for good, and these companies have to stop mass scanning the private chats of European citizens.
The blog post by Patrick Breyer, a former member of the European Parliament and digital freedom fighter, lays out exactly why the system was broken. The evaluation report on chat control was basically an admission of failure. 99% of all chat reports to European police came from just one company, which was Meta.
And the data was mostly garbage. The German Federal Criminal Police Office reported that 48% of the disclosed chats were completely irrelevant to any crime. It was just flooding investigators with junk data. And worse, it was criminalizing teenagers. Around 40% of investigations in Germany were targeting teens who were just thoughtlessly sharing images with each other, like consensual sexting.
Right. And as Breyer points out, trying to protect children with mass surveillance is like trying to mop the floor while leaving the faucet running. It does not work, and it breaks fundamental privacy rights.
The Hacker News discussion on this was incredibly philosophical. A user named Jump Crisscross wrote a brilliant comment about the nature of democracy. They pointed out that in a democracy, if your opposition holds views you do not like, they are going to litigate them for their whole lives. You have to keep defeating them. But the advantage is that unpassed legislation has no force of law. Being on defense and maintaining the status quo is actually a strong position.
I loved that thread. Another user named M. Moose replied to that, arguing that privacy advocates need to stop just playing defense and go on the offense. Pass laws that actively enhance privacy, require end-to-end encryption, impose data retention limits. Make the surveillance advocates spend their resources playing defense for a change.
It is a great point, and we should note the fight is not over. Breyer warns in his post that Chat Control 2.0 is still being negotiated, and the next big threat is mandatory age verification for messengers and app stores, which would effectively kill anonymous communication on the internet. So it is a victory, but the war for digital civil liberties is definitely ongoing.
Shifting gears from global privacy to the trenches of open source development, our next story is a blog post by Markus Unterwaditzer, titled Moving from GitHub to Codeberg for Lazy People.
I love the title. We have seen a lot of grumbling about GitHub over the last few years, especially as Microsoft integrates more AI features and changes the platform's feel. But migrating is always seen as this massive, painful chore. Markus wrote this post to say, hey, it is actually not that bad, depending on your project.
Codeberg, for those who might not know, is a nonprofit collaborative development platform powered by Forgeho, which is a community-driven fork of GitHub. Markus points out that the basic migration of issues, pull requests, and releases is super easy. Codeberg has an import tool that just works, preserving issue numbers, labels, and authorship.
He also mentions they have Codeberg pages, which works a lot like the old GitHub pages. The real pain point, though, is continuous integration, or CI. GitHub has spoiled developers with free macOS runners and infinite capacity for public repos. When you move to Codeberg, you have to give that up. Markus recommends self-hosting a runner for Forgeho Actions, which fortunately uses a YAML syntax almost identical to GitHub Actions.
The Hacker News comments really dug into the philosophy of Codeberg versus GitHub. A user named Norsgate pointed out that Codeberg is not a true one-to-one GitHub replacement because they actively discourage private repositories and non-open source projects. Their FAQ basically says if you are just using them to store commercial projects or media backups, they will not be happy about it.
Which sparked a great debate. Some people felt that was restrictive, but a user named Shimon countered that it is completely fair. Codeberg is a nonprofit. They don't have Microsoft's billions to subsidize loss leaders. They are providing a service for the free and open source community. If you want a place to dump your private scripts or commercial code, you can always spin up your own Git server or pay for a service.
Exactly. GitHub trained a whole generation of developers to expect unlimited free hosting for everything. Unlearning that entitlement is part of the transition to independent, community-run platforms. It's about aligning your tools with your values.
Speaking of developer tools, let's wrap up today with something incredibly practical, a post from the Larvitz blog titled, Shell Tricks That Actually Make Life Easier and Save Your Sanity.
This was such a fun read. The author starts by describing that visceral pain of watching a brilliant engineer hold down the backspace key for 6 continuous seconds to fix a typo at the beginning of a line. We've all been there. You learn the basics of the terminal, and then you just stop optimizing.
Yes, the post breaks down some universal tricks that work on almost any POSIX shell. My absolute favorite, which I use 100 times a day, is Control-W to delete the word before the cursor. Once you build that muscle memory, using backspace feels like digging a hole with a spoon, as the author puts it.
There's also Control-U to cut everything from the cursor to the beginning of the line, and Control-Y to paste it back, perfect for when you write a massive command but suddenly need to run something else first. And of course, Control-A and Control-E to jump to the beginning and end of the line.
The author also mentions the reset command. Have you ever accidentally used the cat command on a compiled binary or a compressed tarball, and your terminal just turns into wingdings and ancient runes?
Oh, absolutely. The terminal just completely breaks.
Right. You do not have to close the window. You just type the word reset and hit enter, even if you cannot see the letters you are typing, and the terminal heals itself. It is magic. He also highlights using cd- to jump back to your previous directory, and using the greater than symbol followed by a file name to instantly empty a file without changing its permissions.
The Hacker News community loves a good terminal workflow thread. A lot of the comments focused on shell history. The author did not mention Control-R for reverse history search, which a lot of commenters brought up as their holy grail.
Though the comments quickly escalated from Control-R to much more powerful tools, people were recommending FZF, which is a command line fuzzy finder, and a tool called Atuin, which replaces your shell history with a SQLite database and lets you sync it across machines.
I saw that. A user named Commander Saki shared a completely different approach, talking about keeping an eternal history file. They have a bash history file going back to 2019 with millions of lines, complete with timestamps. They just use standard grep commands to search their entire working life. It is fascinating how personal terminal setups get. It really is like arranging the furniture in a house you live in for 8 hours a day.
It really is. And taking 10 minutes to learn a few of these shortcuts pays off massive dividends over a career.
Well, that is all we have time for today. 4 very different stories, from the macro-level societal impacts of gambling and EU privacy laws, down to the micro-level of where we host our code and how we type in our terminals.
Thank you all so much for listening to episode 347 of HN Pod. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend or a coworker. We will be back tomorrow with more of the top stories from Hacker News. Have a great day, everyone.